Sallie Mae's.
And this is not. No, this is Jeff Harner, Sallie Mae's partner in the show Double Take at the Laurie Beachton Theater.
On Wednesdays this month at 7 p.m.
And we are delighted to be here on Dave's Gone By.
On UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom, my friends. This is your old pal, Rabbi Sol Solomon, founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And you know, the last time I did a double take, I hurt my neck. I had to take Advil for a week. However, this is a different kind of double take. There's two wonderful people who have done theater and especially cabaret and singing, and they are doing a tag team cabaret show. It's going to be at the Laurie Beachman Theater on two successive Wednesdays, September 21st, as this week, and September 28th. They'll also be at the Cabaret Convention in the middle of October celebrating Stephen Sondheim with a bunch of other brilliant people. So ladies and gentlemen, oh, I can tell you that the woman, she's been on Broadway, she was Tony nominated for She Loves Me, and he's got an award from the Noel Coward Foundation and Mac Awards. We'll talk to them. It'll all come out. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the neighborhood Sallie Mae's and Jeff Harner. Shalom!
Shalom! How are you?
Well, let me ask you the question, Sallie, because I heard you had a thing, like a pneumonia thing last week or something bad?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm all aces now.
Okay, if only Hillary Clinton were as good. No, but seriously. Did you have to perform when you were sick anywhere?
I was on the ending of this. I was like, you know, my last day of antibiotics when we opened last Wednesday at the Laurie Beachman. And so, yeah, I was fine. But it hasn't affected my singing. It just kind of made me feel really wonky.
Oh,
I'm okay.
Because I remember there was an interview on this radio program years ago with another songstress named Maud Maggart, and she mentioned something called doctor theater, where you're sick as a dog, you got 105. The second the light hits you and you go on stage, you're fine. And then you collapse later. Is that true, or do you still feel it on stage, you just push it aside?
I think that's basically true. I think that if there's a certain level of sickness you get to, then you can't do that. But for the most part, I think that works.
Yeah, I mean, leprosy would be difficult. You hit a high note, your nose falls off. This would be a problem.
Problem. Yeah.
What about you, Jeff? Because you, Sally is an actress and a singer. You're more known basically as a singer. Have you had to deal with...
No, I'm known mostly as an actress.
Okay, there we go.
I want to tell you something.
Yeah, please speak a little closer to the your version of a microphone there, Sally. It's a little difficult to hear you at the moment.
All right, can you hear me now?
Oh, much better. Can you hear me now? You should be in a commercial there, yes.
Okay. So, I went to see Jeff Harner in the show that he did last year with our friend K.T. Sullivan that was a Sondheim show, and he's a crackerjack actor.
Oh, I didn't mean to disparage.
Don't let anybody fool you. He's wonderful.
Okay.
I can just throw that right back at you. You should have seen Double Take last week with Sally with double pneumonia, and she was ferocious. I mean, she really, you would never have known she was sick.
Well, what are some of the songs that you do in this double take show?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
What are some of the songs that you are performing in your cabaret show together?
Well, we do everything from old Doris Day rom-com songs to songs.
Sally wrote our opening number. She actually wrote a song called Double Take.
Really?
And yeah. Jeff actually wrote the verse for it. So,
but you'll hear Comden and Green. We do Just in Time.
Just in Time. Did I? Just in Time. Yes. More.
That's the one.
Yeah.
Too Long at the Fair. Come Back to Me.
Mm-hmm.
That's All. We both adore the singer-songwriter Ann Hampton Calloway, and we do her song at the same time.
Because we really feel like we need some of that, and we feel like we need some of that in the world right now.
Oh, well, there you go. And she's a lovely, but we had her on the program a few months ago. Just a delightful lady, Ann Hampton Calloway. Very funny, too.
Oh, I know. Very funny.
I know the theme is that you are working together, but is there a particular theme for the songs that you picked for the show itself?
Well, I would say that This is a very frothy show. That's the way I like to think of it. It's frothy and fun and...
Like Purim! But yes.
That's kind of how it ended up. However, what this came out of, Jeff and I have been doing little one-offs for years. Like, we'll do a benefit here. I did his show at the 92nd Street Y, the 1959 Broadway Songbook. And so we have all these duets that we've been working on for years and learning together. And we did a show up at Yale together. And, you know, I kind of kept saying to him, you know, we're going to have enough duets pretty soon that we can do a show. Then we did have enough. And then we looked at each other and said, but I want more. And so we pulled in our pal, Alex Rybeck, who is our genius arranger and musical director. And we would all get into a room and we would just spitball ideas and laugh. We have had the best time working on this. And we laugh our heads off. And then, you know, we also sing a little bit, too.
So. Oh, yeah. I figure that's in there somewhere. Speaking of which, when did each of you realize that show business was in your blood?
Just now.
And by the end of this conversation, you realize you should have gone into something else. But, you know, seriously, were you 5 years old and performing in front of your family? Was it already in your teens? What?
I've seen the pictures of Sally.
Well, yeah.
She was adorable.
I was hilarious. I was baby June. I was singing when I was 2 years old, man. I was on stage professionally singing. My dad was a jazz musician.
Right.
And which is kind of odd because I grew up in East Texas, but he was a musician and he taught me how to sing from the time I could talk. And so I started out really early. Jeff also did. Jeff made his first foray into New York when he was a little boy with his aunt, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, but I've had all my union cards since I was 10.
Well, you were doing TV commercials as a child.
Yeah,
right?
I did TV jingles when I was a little kid.
I love it.
So, but that was in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sorry.
It's changed when I was about 14, and it's been an uphill climb.
Well,
and I'm not kidding.
No, seriously, that does lead to a question. It's one thing to be a precocious youngster with a nice voice, and everybody tells you you're wonderful, and you take some music lessons and piano lessons, you appear in school. It is quite another to choose this as a career path. What were the difficulties that you, Jeff Hanger, and you, Sally Mays, had to overcome in your strive to the top? Well, the middle, all right.
I'm still striving to the middle.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
Yeah, we're striving to the middle. I mean, I started out in Texas, which is, you know, just in and of itself a hardship because, you know, that's not what I would call the Broadway hub.
Well, I'm sorry, I have to say, once again, sing out, Louise. You sound very far away there, Sally.
Okay, I started out in Texas, and I had to work my way up here before I could really get going. Once I moved up here, I was really, really lucky. 3 months after I moved here, I was on Broadway.
Whoa.
So I was really lucky. But let me just preface that by saying I took a really long time to get here. So, you know, I was in my 20s when I got here. So, you know, late 20s. So it was fortuitous that I ended up in a show like almost immediately. But yeah, it's like it's been a struggle. I've sung, and I mean, I'm sure Jeff has done all the same things I've done. I used to sing jingles too, Jeff, in Dallas.
What do you remember? Do you remember a commercial that you had to do, either of you? I would love to hear the actual.
Oh, yeah, I can tell you my biggest hits.
Oh, please.
Here's a quick medley. What else can you do with Play-Doh? And it's such a great day for Kentucky Fried Chicken and such a bad day to cook. Those were my two biggest.
Hey, those are, yeah.
And mine were Shine Free from Maybelline, Shine Free by Maybelline, and Dewey Stevens, Do You Do Me Right? You know, so it's...
I honestly don't remember those. Even when I was using Maybelline frequently, I don't...
Well, there you go. It was all on cable back then. It was like, that was what they were doing. They were doing when MTV, and it was back when cable wasn't everything. I really enjoyed singing jingles. That business is really pretty much gone now. You know, they mostly pull stuff or they don't use voices, you know.
Wait, what do you mean? They auto-tune? What do you mean they don't use voices?
Well, they'll either pull a recording of Rosemary Clooney.
Oh, right, yeah.
Something, or they'll have a voiceover, but or they'll, you know, or they'll use some, you know, they'll use a recording that already exists.
Oh, right, yeah.
There aren't that many, you know, actual jingles to be sung anymore. And so it's kind of become a dying art form.
What about the things that we don't think about? Because usually we think, oh, it's a singer. They either have a pop career or they're in the theater singing that way or in cabaret. What about for sitcom opening songs or, you know, the
That's Anne Hampton Calloway.
That's Miss Anne Hampton Calloway.
Yeah.
She's the one that did that. No, I mean, you know.
She wrote the theme to The Nanny.
Right, right. But then there are some other sitcoms out there, you know, and another show. But I guess there aren't that many sitcom theme songs anymore.
Honestly, most of the sitcoms are shot in Los Angeles and or in Atlanta now. It seems to be a big hub for shooting stuff. There's a lot of stuff here, but most of it's like cop shows and they're gritty.
Yeah.
No, that's how she became the nanny. You know, they don't have that.
They don't have that. Now it's gonna be, oi, I'm gonna shoot you, put down the gun. You know, it's not the same. Yes.
Honestly, there's a big list of people that do that kind of work out in Los Angeles, you know, so, and that business is really one of the, well, all of show business is like this to a certain extent, but the jingle business is really and honestly who you know, and so.
But having done it for so long, both of you, didn't you know people?
I knew people in my area.
I was 10. Those people are dead.
Yes.
Listen, I made a push when I got up here, and I didn't have any luck at all. And it was already starting to die by the time I moved up here. And listen, people in Dallas, I could call them.
Well, so let me ask you, how did you get that big? What did you audition with when you got that first big break in Welcome to the Club? What was your? Do you remember what song you sang?
Yes.
What was it?
Mr. Paganini.
Okay.
And Cy Coleman lost his mind. He was so impressed with that because I did it like just like Ella. And I did Mr. Paganini, and then, of course, they immediately cast me as a country western singer.
All right. But now, Welcome to the Club was not a hit. So did you, I always ask this of Broadway people, if they can tell, like, even before opening night, before the reviews come out, whether, or they think the day before, like the last dress rehearsal or the final preview, they think, oh, this is, we're going to have a hit. Could you tell?
Well, I was very green when I first moved up here, and I was just thrilled to be at the party. And the way that I actually got this, they fired the girl. I was hired as a swing, and they fired the girl that I was swinging for, and put me on and then ultimately gave me the job. And so I was just like thrilled to be at the party. And honestly, before the reviews came out, everybody would come and they would laugh so hard at Marilyn Sokol and so hard at Avery Shriver. And the music was great, you know, and it wasn't until the reviews came out that I really realized on that one that we were in big trouble. But we did have tons and tons and tons and tons of rehearsals, you know, like all through previews, and they kept changing and fixing and changing and fixing. So that was kind of a clue, but it really wasn't completely clear that they were going to kill it until they did. Now, on Urban Cowboy, when I was doing that years later,
yeah,
I had a cast member come by my dressing room to bring me a card on opening night. And he looked at me and said, what do you think is going to happen? And I said, sweetie, do you want me to be honest or do you want me to be optimistic?
Oh, boy.
Well, I want you to be honest. And I said, don't buy a paper tomorrow. And he went, oh, I don't think it's that bad. And I said, okay, have a great show. Because it's like, I knew that one was. That was like being on the Titanic.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow. Yeah. So there wasn't even during rehearsals and late rehearsals and previews. But before the critics came in, audiences, I'm sure, were kind of enjoying it. What was the clue in your head that said, we're going to be in trouble?
Well, if you want to know, honestly, I'm a Texan, and I grew up in Houston, I mean, the Houston area, and I knew. I think that when people comment on a group of people rather than embrace them, and that's kind of what happened with that, I think. I think that it wasn't, I think that if you don't understand Texans, you can't write them. And that's just my opinion.
Okay, no, that's fine. By the way, we should mention that for all the floppiness of these two shows, you did win a Theater World Award debut in 1992 for...
Oh, listen, I am so grateful for Welcome to the Club because the day after it closed, I got my second job, and which was closer than ever.
Oh.
So I am nothing but grateful, and Cy Coleman stayed my friend for the rest of his life, and I loved him dearly. And I'm even grateful for Irving Cowboy because I, you know, I had a lot of fun. You know, it was a crazy group of people, and it was fun. So...
Now, Jeff, I will get to you in a moment, but since we're on this, I should just mention Cy Coleman again. He is one of the legendary people in Broadway composing songwriting. So, any Cy Coleman memories of your friendship? Any funny anecdotes?
My favorite Cy Coleman moment, and it is that I was involved with a tribute to Nettie Condon and Adolph Green at the Berkshire Theater Festival, and it was one of those all-star kind of things, and I was a kid on the block. I was swept up into it because I was doing a show celebrating Condon and Green in a cabaret room in New York, and I got up to the Berkshire Theater Festival, and they said, to relax, we've got a dinner for you before the show, so just make yourself down. It was at the Red Lion Inn. So I went down and they seated me with Tyne Daly, Lauren Bacall,
wow.
Cy Coleman, and Judy Kaye to relax.
It's kind of a shame they didn't put anybody famous near you. Yeah.
To Lauren Bacall, and she said, you're the 13-year-old that's getting all the good reviews. And I said, well, thank you. And she said, tell me everything. Tell me everything. And I said, well, I started doing cabaret because I wasn't getting cast on Broadway, and she learned over. She goes, Cy, why can't the kid get a Broadway show? And he just shrugged. That's my Cy Coleman story.
Okay, there you go. I mean, it's funny, Lauren Bacall actually said something to you, and there were no four-letter words in it. That's kind of a shock.
I know, and you know, during the show, she, you know, I was standing backstage, and she came up to me, and she said, you're having the best time, aren't you?
Oh.
Yeah, I really am. I have nothing but lovely things to say about her.
No, so do I. I mean, she was a great... shall we say, a great old broad, and I don't mean that in a bad way. She was a salty, Elaine Stritchy kind of a lady, you know? But what about you? You, Sally, you were, as you said, friends with Cy Coleman for the rest of his life. Did he do more for you than shrug?
Well, first of all, let me just say that Jeff is the best person in the world to have in your audience or in your orbit, actually, because he's positive and loving and hilarious. And so I just want to say that. But then let's go back to
Okay.
My favorite Cy story is, well, I have a million of them, but my favorite one is they called and asked me to come up and do, you know, Paul Newman used to have this place, well, it's still there, God rest his soul, the cancer camp that he had
of course.
In Connecticut.
And by the way, he was Jewish. I just wanted to throw that in there, but yes.
Okay, well, when they had... they had a thing every year. They would do this great big fundraiser, and all of these stars would come and work on their little stage, and it was like doing skits on stage, right? It was so crazy and so much fun. And let me see, who was there my year? Bebe Snow, Carole King, Glenn Close, Alec Baldwin, Amy Grant. I mean, it was like one of those kind of nights, right? And then Paul and Joanna, of course, Jimmy Naughton. And so we're there, and you know, we're working on the skits, and everybody's laughing and having a great time. Aggie Hotcher, who was booked for Welcome to the Club, was also. They were kind of all part of this posse. They were all real good friends, and they all lived in Connecticut, right?
Uh-huh.
And Cy wasn't there, and I kept asking people. And they were like, oh, he'll be here in a little bit. And where Cy was there was a little boy in the ward who wanted to play jazz piano. And every year when Cy would come up there, he would spend time with him and, you know, teach him and sit and visit with him and stuff, and the little boy died that weekend, and so it was really, that's a downer of a story.
Yeah, well, way to bring the show down. Thank you, Sally.
But just the fact that he was so completely available and open and there for that little boy, I thought it was the most wonderful thing I'd ever seen in my life. He was so incredible, and so that's my favorite story, because he spent, like, you know, hours every day that we were up there.
Well, that was sweet and heartwarming, which I hate. So, how about your second favorite Cy Coleman story, one that is light and amusing and perhaps a little salty?
Well, okay, I was driving around in my home, my town where I live here. You know, I'm a mom and I live up in Westchester County, and I was driving around doing grocery shopping and errands and stuff one day, you know, and the phone rings and I see that it's Cy Coleman, and I hadn't talked to him in a long time. And he said, "Hi, Sally, it's Cy." And I went, "Yeah, I know, what's up?" And he was like, "Well, we're working on this jazz musical, and we did it at the Kennedy Center, and it was with Janet Siegel and Lilias White, and you know, and Janet is not going on with it, and so I want you to come and sing for the Bergmans, because you know I think you'd be great for this." And I said, "Oh, sorry, that's so nice, thank you." And he went, "I'm not offering you the job." And I went, "That's okay." I said, "What do you want me to bring? You have something you want to hear?" And he said, "Bring everything."
Okay.
I called my friend Johnny Rogers, and I asked him to meet me, and we went over to Cy's townhouse, and we go up, and Pat Birch and Cy and Marilyn and Alan Bergman, who I'd never met, were there, and so basically I did my club act. I did everything I had, and they were like all clapping and laughing, and I would tell my jokes and stuff, and I did my whole club act for them, and then I didn't get the job.
Oh!
So I think that's hilarious. I'm sorry.
It's nice that you're kind of optimistic, too, because if somebody did that to me, you know, they'd find Cy Coleman in the bottom of a river.
Well, he did say right up front.
Well, no, he did say that, but you always have that little hope, that inkling, you know, that jealousy of somebody else getting the part. You know, I'm sure it has affected both of you over the years.
I thought it was really funny.
Oh, okay.
It ended up not coming in, and so I didn't feel that bad about it, actually. So it never came into town, and so I didn't feel that bad about it. But it was just, I thought it was really funny that I did my whole club act and then didn't get the job.
Well, what about you, Jeff? Have you auditioned for things that you thought were, like, you know, right in the pocket, and either they surprisingly, or did you do a terrible audition one time, and you got the gig, and you were shocked?
You know, the thing is, I don't audition. I mean, I did do that a lot when I was at NYU, and I have gone in for auditions when I've been asked. But I really discovered 30 years ago that I enjoy doing cabaret, where I create the show, and I give myself the lead, or the co-starring part in this case. And so I really don't have a lot of audition stories to tell you. It's one of the things, one of the great joys for me about doing cabaret, is that it taps into all the different things I like to do as far as creating the show and performing it and promoting it and, you know, doing the graphic design and the artwork and all of that. All of that lights me up. What doesn't light me up is going into a room and having 16 bars to sing for somebody.
Sure.
And hoping that they'll totally get who I am and think that I'm right for their show.
That's fair.
So I do have some audition stories, but they're not like what Sally just told you. You know, nothing.
Can I just add to that? It's like, I think that most of us who are intelligent, creative, talented people want to have a little bit of control, and as an actor, you never have control. You don't have any control as an actor. You go in the room, and it's up to other people whether or not you're going to get the job. Then when you have the job, it's up to other people how the job is done and how it's directed and how it's presented and what costumes you're going to be wearing. You don't have control. And when you're doing what Jeff and I are doing here, we got to control how all of this went. We got to decide what songs are going to be sung by whom, and we were able to decide what kind of arrangements we wanted to do and who we wanted to use as our band. And, you know, you have control. You're behind the wheel. And that's one of the reasons why I always come back to cabaret, even though I do also act. It's because I like that feeling of being in charge of my destiny.
But here's the question, especially for Jeff, is in New York cabaret alone, I can't imagine, unless you're maybe Jim Caruso, that you can just make a living doing that. You have to, I assume. You make your money touring, I guess, and in concert halls, no?
I, Is that the question of
yeah.
how I make my living?
Yeah. Well, because nobody makes a living at Don't Tell Mama and 88s, you know?
No, I look at my career, its footing here in New York thanks to the cruise ship industry.
Ah.
You know, 30 years ago, as soon as I got a New York Times review, I was able to get cruise ship work, and that helped me fund doing more cabaret work in the city. And those dates are what I call prestige dates, where I get the reviews that get me work out of town. And now I'm very fortunate that there are, I do symphony orchestra work, there's the performing arts centers around the country. I haven't done a cruise in the last 3 years, but I'm about to do one in November, so I'm looking forward to that again, because that really is a wonderful way to work. But it really, you know, what changed my life as a cabaret performer is the New York Times review. You know,
was it Stephen Holden, or who was the reviewer back
Stephen
then?
Stephen Holden.
Yeah.
Yes, 30, believe it or not, it was in 1988, 30 whatever years ago. That changed my life. After that New York Times review, I never had to wait tables again.
Well, actually, also, I have down here...
Nothing wrong with that.
No. In fact, back in 1992, you were performing in Chicago, and the critic for the Chicago Tribune wrote, and I quote, "Jeff Harner knows how to make..." Oops, I just lost the screen there. "Knows how to make a meticulously conceived show seem spontaneous. He even makes it look easy, which it isn't."
Oh.
I don't know if you ever saw that preview, but it's up there.
Again, I love that.
I like that. That's good, Jeff.
And then, now, Jeff, another question for you. Now, me, occasionally, I like a nice glass of Manischewitz, you know, and chocolate. Those tend to be my vices. You went through some shit, if you don't mind my saying. You were addicted to a few things. How the hell did that happen?
Oh, really? I thought you wanted to keep it up and optimistic.
Well, you came out of it. You're not dead. You know, if you had done a Janis Joplin, it would be different. But you're here. You're fine. You're good.
Well, it ain't over yet. So I just take it one day at a time, literally and figuratively. Yeah, I did. I had my challenges and my struggles. And, you know, it's...
But why, if you had music, if you had art, and the acclaim of people watching you in an audience... What more did you need? Why did you have to turn to substances?
Oh, it didn't happen quite that way.
Oh.
So, no, it wasn't that the audience wasn't enough or the music wasn't enough. It was that I wasn't enough. And it's taken me a long time to come to that kind of inner peace that I'm okay just being a human being. Not a human doing, but just a human being. And I'm very fortunate that I'm surrounded by loving, lovely, lovely people in my life today. I have just, you know, so much gratitude for the road I've taken and how I've gotten to where I am, and that I get to do what I love to do still, and that I didn't burn too many bridges along the way.
I'd just like to plug in there and say that Jeff is one of the kindest, gentlest, most loving people that I've ever worked with, and I think that he's an incredible person, and I think he is a courageous and strong person, and I back him to the hilt.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'm not saying anything otherwise. It's just sometimes when we talk about the, you know, it's like Behind the Music on VH1. It'd be kind of boring if it was just, well, everything was wonderful for them for 28 minutes.
I see.
Yeah, no, it's just like, well, how did you hit the lows, and then how did you come out of the lows and come back to this peaceful, zen-like, happy person with loving people all around you? That was really the question, you know. So who is there a particular loving person around you these days? Hint, hint?
No, actually. You mean a significant roommate I do not have, but there is just more nurturing, loving people around me today than there ever have been. So, and I'm very, you know, that's the other great thing about doing a cabaret act with someone like Sally is nobody cast me in that. I don't have to do that. That's something we do because we love being with each other. And, you know, she lights me up. And so if I can do that and make music, you know.
Well, you like to, Jeff, you also like to challenge yourself, I think, sometimes taking on what I would call the Danny Kaye-like numbers. The ones that are kind of verbal and...
Love me some patter songs.
Patter song, that's the word, yeah.
Yes.
Because
39 seconds, I'll give you Tchaikovsky.
Do it up.
They're sort of like doing a crossword puzzle for me. They just really, I love Cole Porter. I love Stephen Sondheim. I love Condé Brandon Green. I just really marvel at these people who can craft these kind of lyrics, that, and it makes me look witty and intelligent by memorizing them. So they're just like a win-win for me.
See, I try to do that with the Haftorah. Doesn't work. Doesn't work at all.
Now, Sally can write those things, so there you go.
Actually, did either of you ever do the bar mitzvah circuit?
Not I.
Have not.
Oh, you missed so much. Yeah. Oh. The gefilte fish cake, it's a wonderful thing. But Sally, you have a Broadway and cabaret life, which means travel, which means all of that, while having a husband, while having a kid. What compromises did you have to make, if any? Or is that sort of the ideal? When you're sick of the family, you can go on a plane for a week.
Oh, well, I don't think I get sick of my family.
I think having to work with me is one of the great compromises she's made.
It's one of the best things ever. Listen, I will tell you this. I feel like if anything got compromised, it was my career. But from where I'm coming from, if you have a choice between your kid and a show or your kid and a job, there is no choice. I wanted to have a child. I wanted to raise him. I love him more than anything in this world. And so I was happy to do that. You know,
he is her best work, I must say.
Quite
remarkable.
And, you know, I'm so proud of him. He's at Manhattanville in his junior year. He's a poli sci major, and he would hate that I'm talking about him, so I won't too much. But, you know, he's an amazing
kid. He did officiate at their 25th wedding anniversary.
That's right.
That was adorable.
He looked like Hawkeye Pierce in his little hat and his Hawaiian shirt, and we stood down by the water, and he talked about both of us, and then he let us clasp hands and renew our vows, and which brings me to my husband, who is, you know, he's chaired 15 Broadway shows as a bass player, and he is an amazing Juilliard graduate musician, and one of the best people I know. We've had a wonderful, wonderful life together. So, you know,
he's very codependent, though. He insists on standing on stage during our entire show just to keep an eye on us.
Oh well, you know.
He doesn't want us to run off together or anything, you know, which could happen, you know.
It could. You never in show business. You never know what can happen with people.
Oh, he's our bass player. He's our bass.
I know. Well, that's the thing, Sally. You were wise because you never date a drummer. Any other instrument, it's fine, but they tell you, never the drummer. Be careful with those. So you were very wise.
I know what my thing is.
You know what you call a drummer without a girlfriend? Homeless.
No, what I never was never date actors. That just seemed to me to be a recipe for disaster. So
did you ever, and it was?
If I ever dated, I think I did in college, maybe, but it was never, you know. Actually, one time when I was very young in college, and it was a disaster.
Oh.
He was just a cheater and an evil man. But everybody else that I dated was like, they were like techies or, you know, stage managers or stuff like that. And musicians, I always went for the musicians. So, really, no, I just always felt that would be a bad idea to date actors.
And what about, I know, Jeff, you seem like a more private person, but what about you? What, you're dating musicians, actors, lawyers?
Neither. No.
Astronauts?
All,
no.
all of the men in my life, and we are way into double digits. We're neither musicians, performers, actors.
Was that a conscious choice?
No. It just kind of worked out that way, but I think it, you know, just dovetailing on what Sally said, you don't kind of find the best pool of people. She found a winner with Bob, I'll tell you that. He's a great guy.
Well, you know, I will also say, you know, I love all my actor friends. I love every single one of them. But that doesn't mean that I would want... I think that if you are in a business where you both do the same thing, that it's really hard.
It's hard.
You know, and I think it would be easier to try to... And also, just because, you know, you try to be a well-rounded, eclectic person. So, you know, you want to know about other things than just besides acting and the theater. You want to know about a lot of different things in life. And so, you know, one of the things about my husband is he is my handyman. He can fix anything. He can fix anything. If the car breaks down, he fixes it. If the dryer breaks, he fixes it. It's like, he's amazing, and he's smart, and he's funny and witty, and we have such a good time together. So, and we don't make our whole life about the business, and that, I think, has kept me sane, you know?
That's huge. And I also want to ask, since we're talking about teaching and learning, in a sense, two different things, one for both of you. First of all, Jeff, you went to the alma mater of my friend Dave, who is the host of this radio program, NYU. And not too long after he was there. So, do you have any great memories of NYU Tisch? That's what it was called. It was Tisch School of the Arts, but, you know, it still is, actually, yeah.
Any great memories about NYU? I'll tell you, my favorite thing about NYU is that I went to it when I did, which was when New York was just a really tough place to be. You know, I first came to NYU in 1979, and... You know, walking to my classes on 42nd Street, if you weren't depressed before you got off the subway, you were depressed by the time you passed.
No, wait. So wait, were your classes at Circle in the Square? Because NYU was downtown on West 4th.
I was at, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, we were uptown at on 42nd Street at a place called the Actors and Directors Lab, which is now the Harold Clermont Theater.
Oh.
And it was just like a battlefield. It was like World War II up there, you know, just... The people, the sordid.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really glad I got to experience and, you know, see what New York has become, the way, especially that area of the city, the rebirth of it and reinvention. But those are some of my most profound memories. I mean, it was also a great time just with, I remember Angela Lansbury coming and giving us a master class, and Carol Shelley. Liz Suedos was one of my teachers. Uh-huh. It was a great time. It was a golden age.
No, I mean, in a way, Dave tells me his stories about going to Tisch from like 1981 till the mid 80s. So it was pretty similar. But for you, Sally, you are occasionally teaching. I think we're at the Texas University there. I have it somewhere. Texas State University.
I did a master class at, you know, my friend Caitlin Hopkins is the head of the drama department at TSU.
Oh, okay.
I was down visiting, and I went and did a master class for her. And
So what is, tell people who aren't necessarily theater geeks what a master class consists of. It's not a recital. You are working with kids in what way?
Well, they get up and sing for me, and then I tweak them a little bit, and I teach song performance for the most part. I was part of the Cabaret Conference at Yale for 12 years and was a master teacher there, and basically what you do is you just help them perform their song better. You help them understand their material better. You help them present the story, tell the story better. I'm a good storyteller, and so I like to help people with that.
What is it? So get a little deeper in that, if you wouldn't mind. Like, if you have a song and the lyrics seem to be clear, how do you tell a story in song, without pictures, without projections, without other people on stage, just you? So what is that, a dog behind you? What is that noise behind you there?
Yes, it's children, unfortunately.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay.
It will pass.
Well, you know, I think that you're asking me to explain how I do what I do. And
well,
I don't know if we have enough time for that, but I can tell you that sometimes people get up and sing a song and they don't need any help, but there are often technical things that they need, like don't close your eyes when you're singing about something that is emotional to you, or, you know, don't put your mouth right directly on the microphone, or, you know, maybe you don't want to wave your hands around in the air while you're doing that. You should limit your gestures to have meaning, and you should try to present the story in a clear way so that the audience can understand it and so that we see your heart, you know?
Okay.
So that's what I try to convey and help them convey. And
that's major. That's kind of what I was going for. And how about you, Jeff? What's the best advice you ever got in so far as putting across a song in a cabaret or concert situation?
There are several. pieces of great advice. I worked with a teacher named Sarah Louise Lazarus, and she actually ended up directing my first 7 shows in New York. But she was the one who really, I came in and I sang a song for her called If I Love Again. And she said, yeah, how beautiful, but how dare you? How dare you sing If I Love Again when you look like you're 19? Which, you know, at that time I was 30. The point being that it's paying attention to the lyrics and realizing that as a singer, the lyrics are my script, and it needs to be absolutely believable, these words coming out of my mouth. So she really guided me toward finding words that were appropriate and how to personalize them in a way that made my message unique. I used to believe that certain songs belonged to Judy Garland, that they belonged to Frank Sinatra. But if you really take the lyric and break it down into your own personal monologue, then it's a definitive version of a song. It may not be, you know, the chart topper that theirs were, but my rendition of a song will be as valid as theirs, because if I really brought everything I can to the, you know, who am I singing to? Why am I singing it? Where am I when I'm singing it? And when I teach a master class, those are the things I try and help students guide them to, is, you know, let's get this as specific as we can, because then it's absolutely your version of a song that will be unique and profoundly its own. And when I go to see a cabaret act, that's what I'm looking for, is someone who can just really, you know, really take me into a very unique personal experience. And I get to go to a master class every Wednesday night at the Laurie Beachman Theater watching 3 days.
And I feel the same way. You know, what's really kind of great about songs is that there are going to be a million different takes on a song. You know,
that's right.
just because, you know, Judy Garland sang Somewhere Over the Rainbow her way, it doesn't negate the way that Sam Harris did it years later. I mean, you know, there are always, there's always another way in, and it's always going to be unique and personal because it's your way in. You know, I have
you may have
like
heard Frank Sinatra sing That's All, but wait till you hear Sally and
wait
I do it.
I'm always having people like contact me and ask me if they can have my arrangement of this and my arrangement of that. And I know what they want. They want the sheet music, right? But I don't have the sheet music. What I have is my arrangement that I've worked out with my musical director and paid him to do for me. And so I'm not going to give you that. And also, if you do my arrangement, then you're not doing you. So you have to do your own take on this. And so what I usually do is I tell them that in the nicest way possible, and then I direct them to where they can go to get the sheet music so they can find their own unique take on it, right? Or I offer to help them with that.
It's true, because, you know, for years I've shied away from singing Shaving Cream because it so belonged to Benny Bell. But now you've given me the confidence to make that one my own, I think. I think I can do it now.
I think you can do it, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking with the delightful and fun and musical Jeff Harner and Sally Mays. They're going to be both at the Cabaret. Well, first of all, they're going to be at the Cabaret Convention celebrating Stephen Sondheim. That is Wednesday, October 19th at Rose Hall in Lincoln Center. But also, you're going to see them, of course, as they said, at the Laurie Beachman Theater. There are two Wednesdays. It's the 21st, it's this Wednesday, and also Wednesday, September 28th. Now, for more information on this, on Double Take, please go visit their individual websites and to see all the other things that Sally and Jeff are doing. So there's sallymayes.net, M-A-Y-E-S, sallymayes.net, and jeffharnar.com, and it's H-A-R-N-A-R. Kind of, you know, it's hard to remember that, but it's jeffharnar.com. Please go visit them. Check them out. Last question before I bid you a very fond and wonderful adieu. What is each of your very, very favorite songs ever? Yeah, I know.
It's like asking someone to choose between children.
Well, I've done that. Solomon, you know, Solomons are known for that. Yeah.
Sophie's Choice. You hit it, Sally.
The Next One I Learned.
Oh, boy. Give me the glucose index on that. But that's really cool. I like that. Then I'll ask you, what song are you working on right now?
Well, actually, I'm working on a song that I'm writing right now.
Ooh.
And it's called Not Yet. And it's Alex Rybak, our musical director, is writing the music with me. And so, it's always the next thing. It's always, people ask me what my favorite show is, and it's always the next one. You know, it's always the next one, because you never know what's going to come down the pike yet. And how lucky are we that we get to do this? This is what we do for a living. This is what we do for our life career. This is, we chose our passion. And so it's wonderful to look ahead and say, what next? What's next? You know?
That's grand. Before I ask you, Jeff Harner, the same question about the song, it does remind me that I never even got to talk with you, Sally, about Closer Than Ever. Do you have any memories of that show, which really, it ran for a year, kind of put you on the map, really, in New York, even though it was off-Broadway. It was not Broadway. But lots of awards. People loved that show. It was revived, two seasons ago. Any memories of Closer Than Ever?
So many that I don't even know where to begin, except to say that I was fortunate enough to not only meet my husband doing that show, because he was the bass player, but also to meet my musical director for 21 years, Mr. Patrick Brady, who is not in the business anymore. He left the business. But I was lucky enough to have both those guys come into my life because of Closer Than Ever, not to mention that wonderful cast, because all of them are still friends of mine. And so it was really, really, I was handed the best material a girl could ever ask for. So, you know, Miss Bird has followed me around for years. You will never find any complaints about doing that, because it was one of the great memories of my life.
And Jeff, the best song, see, I haven't forgotten you, the best favorite song of all, maybe not to sing, but just of anywhere.
Well, my answer would be inspired by what Sally was just saying, and it would be the one I'm performing right now. Anytime I have an opportunity to get up on a stage and be, you know, really investing myself in a song that I've chosen, that I, you know, really feel strongly about, those songs, I just really appreciate the opportunity to sing songs that I love right now. So, for instance, in the double take show that we're doing right now, I get to sing an Aznavour song called "There Is a Time," which I just adore, and
which he killed.
An Alan J. Lerner, Burton Lane song called "Come Back to Me." That just, you know, the lyrics just don't get any better than that. And I also get to sing an original song by my musical director Alex Rybak, which is a hoot. And I love to be doing that, to be putting music out there by the people, around me who should be household names that are not yet.
Well,
songwriter.
The two people who we've been talking to should be, well, they are in New York, but they should be household names everywhere. Their names are Sally Mays, Jeff Harner. See them at the Laurie Beachman Theater this Wednesday and next Wednesday night. I want to thank you both so very, very much for being so delightful in the neighborhood, and much continued music and success. May the next 100,000 songs that you sing be the best ones ever.
Oh, thank you so much.
Perfect.
Shalom to you guys.
Bye-bye, Rabbi Saul.
Bye-bye.